Today we are coming to Aristotle. I think of all of the people we will cover, probably Aristotle on the one hand and Augustine on the other will be the two most difficult to compress into one presentation. So I'm reserving the right to not get done. I promise you I will not go over. But we might have a little bit of, leftovers to pick up next time. We'll see how it goes. So, let's have a word of prayer now that our tardy students are arriving. Get underway. It's okay. So, what I'd like to do is, good afternoon, faculty. Oh, that's nice. Oh, the years I've waited for this. Yes, dear.
I just want to say that our no spelling word today was hair.
Father, we're grateful to you for your continual mercies. We thank you for those in history who you've given insight to. We pray that we can learn from these things. We pray that as we have evaluate this most influential character, that you would give us discerning minds and hearts, thoughts, insights, all to the glory of Christ, in whose name we pray. Amen. All right, Aristotle, as you know, is the principal student, most important student of Plato. Plato, you recall from last time, synthesized two great philosophical traditions, and those traditions are Parmenides and Heraclitus. Parmenides was from the general region of Ionia, and Heraclitus was from
Italia.
Remember, it's the squeeze play. So you've got Italy on the one hand, Ionia on the other. Greece kind of becomes the place where it all winds up, but that's not where it starts. And so you have, or as you also might say, in Ionia you have the Democrats, and in Italy you have the Republicans, although you wouldn't know it by today's Republicans. But nevertheless, that would at least be the traditional view. Who does Plato prefer? Who does he give more of his allegiance to in his philosophy? Parmenides. And I was estimating, 70% or something like that, Parmenides. So he wants to acknowledge Heraclitus and his contribution that the world is a changing place. He accommodates that in his receptacle world. But for Plato, all the action is in the ideal world. That's really what he's concerned about. And so whenever we think of being Platonic, we usually think of being a little bit otherworldly, because that's where reality is. This world is disparaged to some degree, and it's those ideas that really captivate him. Well, Aristotle is just the opposite. I heard one guy lecturing on Aristotle once give the following three comparisons. So I'm just going to give these to you, and we'll kind of unpackage them as we go along, but it may just be a place to kind of start thinking about him. He said of Aristotle that Aristotle is scientific rather than metaphysic, which isn't very good grammar, but scientific rather than metaphysic. Second, that he emphasizes observation rather than intuition. Observation rather than intuition. And finally, that Aristotle is concerned for causation rather than valuation. Causation rather than valuation. I don't want to try to explain those yet. You probably have some idea what's going on just hearing them. But hopefully we'll return to them at the end and think about what they mean. Just a quick sketch on Aristotle's life, just so we get into some kind of time frame. He was born in 384. So, what does that mean? 15 years or so after the death of Socrates. In that period of Greek malaise, the Peloponnesian Wars, they've beaten themselves up. And they're kind of now asking why, you know. And of course, Plato's given his answer. Aristotle is born now, kind of, you know, midstream in that. He was sent to Athens at 18 years of age to study under the most famous thinker, scholar in the world, Plato. So he has that privilege. His father was the doctor to the king of Macedon. So Aristotle is Macedonian. And that's important because the Greeks tended to look down on the Macedonians. They were kind of rude. They were a little backwater, you know. I mean, Athens, that was where the real action was. Macedon. To say someone was from Macedon back then would be sort of like me saying, wow, there's this great guy from Washtakna. You know, and you go, that's great. But, you know, it's kind of that feeling, just sort of out there in the woods. And so they weren't prepared for a great genius like Aristotle to come from those quarters. Anyway, Aristotle studied under Plato for a few years, and he was so brilliant that Plato, of course, kept him on. And so Aristotle became a co-teacher at the academy with Aristotle, or with Plato, for many years. In fact, until the death of Plato, which was in, but you have your notes handy? What year did Plato die? Remember that? 3, note takers, 47. Aristotle was very upset because Plato did not leave the academy to Aristotle, but left it to a cousin of his who was not a tenth of the mind of Aristotle. And Aristotle was so incensed at the insult that he just left. So he quit, you know. And so he was human, in spite of his genius, a little bit disturbed by that. So he went traveling around. This is in now 347. He travels for about 5 years. And then he gets a call from Philip II to come and tutor his very bright son, whose name happened to be Alexander. And so Aristotle becomes the tutor to Alexander, who would eventually be, of course, Alexander the Great, when Alexander was in his early teens, maybe 12, 13, 14 years old. Tutors him for about 2 or 3 years, something like that. Then he there's another 5 years or so that's somewhat obscure. It seems that he probably stayed in the region of Macedon and probably continued to be active in the court of Philip II. But, of course, Philip, you may recall, was assassinated in 336, and that's when Alexander, of course, became king of Macedon and shortly thereafter launched his whirlwind campaign to take over the world. And so Aristotle moved back to Athens and started a competing school. Goes into head-to-head competition with the academy, and the name of Aristotle's school was, anybody happen to know off the top of your head, the name of his school? The Lyceum, L-Y-C-E-A-M. It was a peripatetic school. What does that mean, Mr. Ingard? A peripatetic school. It's not the kind of school Mr. Williams would approve of. Yes. They go on field trips every day. Every day they're out walking through. This is what Mr. Dykstra would, of course, relish. Because Aristotle is a scientist. And what better way to learn the truth of all of things except out there in the middle of it. So peripatetic is from the Greek word peripateto, which means to walk. And hence it's a school in which the classroom is a walking place. You walk around. He was there for just over 10 years. He left in 323 because that was the year, you may recall, that Alexander died. And there was a lot of anti-Macedonian sentiment in Athens, even though You know, Alexander was a great guy, and so the Athenians still had this prejudice against Macedon, and even against Alexander, and even though they'd been fully dominated by the Macedonians, they nevertheless felt some degree of hostility. And Aristotle was concerned that with the death of Alexander, there might be reprisals against him. And his famous last words as he left Athens just after the death of Alexander were, his words were, anybody know that little piece of trivia? I want to prevent Athens from sinning twice. What does that mean? I want to prevent Athens from committing the same sin twice. Mr. Fugit.
They killed Socrates.
That's right. That's right. He kind of saw the handwriting on the wall. He wasn't nearly as heroic as Socrates, who of course would have stayed on principle as he did. Socrates could have left Athens. He had, you know, he was offered exile. He wouldn't take it. He's going to go down in principle, drink the hemlock, make a statement. Aristotle says, I don't think so. You know, I'm out of here. So anyway, Aristotle decided to... But of course, it was for the Athenians' benefit. He was not doing it for himself. Anyway, be that as it may, he died the next year. He died in 322, so probably wouldn't have died any later had he, or earlier, if he'd stayed in Athens. But anyway, that's his quick sketch of the story. When we think of Aristotle, it's hard to know where to begin, and this is one of those where I'll feel some frustration. I guess what I'm going to do is give you, first of all, the basic organization of his writings. Because it seems like a good idea, you know. Aristotle is deadly boring to read. That's just the way it is. Plato is much more engaging. Plato kind of writes with a dialogical style, and you sort of get into the story, and you know, you kind of feel the movement. And Plato's a good writer. Aristotle is not such a good writer, but to say this in his defense, much of what we have that is purported to be the writings of Aristotle isn't. It's rather notes taken from lectures that he gave. So a lot of what we know of as the writings of Aristotle is actually a distilling of lecture notes by his students. And I have to say to you, if I were to give a wonderful scintillating lecture, let's say, in, you know, some class, and then I were to depend on people to reconstruct the notes of my lecture 10 years later and produce it, I fear it might lose something. You know, I think maybe some of the original zest might be lost. And I think that's what happened. I think Aristotle himself was probably a brilliant lecturer, and he was a very good writer. And the writings we have from him are quite good. Not as good as Plato, but pretty good. But the stuff that's kind of secondhand is more difficult. But be that as it may, his writings are generally organized into four classes. So anyone that knows anything about Aristotle should know these four. This is kind of a place to begin. The first class or body of writings is called the Organon. The Organon, which ought to remind you of an English word. What English word immediately comes to mind? It's actually more than one, but...
Organize.
Pardon me? Organism. That's good. Organization. All of those. And that is what he intended. This is really where he deals with the general subject of logic. So he doesn't consider this a branch of his writings, he considers this something prior to it. This is preliminary. This is what is necessary in order to say anything about anything. So he actually has to come up with the rules of knowledge as such. Before you talk about the knowledge of biology or the knowledge of, you know, anything, you've got to have the knowledge of knowledge. Just how does communication work? So, and this is really, you know, where often you go first with Aristotle's thought, and I'll spend a little bit of time on that. So the Organon, logic. The second branch is usually called his theoretic science. Oops, I forgot. Ms. Muse is in here. I find that when I write legibly, then I am not sure I'm spelling it right, you see, because I'm so used to seeing it scribbled. And I take comfort in the scribbling. You know? Who knows? But this really, this you're kind of smoked out into the open when you write legibly. You either know how to spell it or you don't. You know? No place to hide. All right, these are the subjects that he covers under theoretic science. I'll just tick them off. Physics, mathematics, metaphysics, biology, psychology, anthropology. Maybe I should just say in passing, of course, Aristotle intended to say everything that could be said on every subject. You understand that. You know, the idea of being a specialist didn't occur to him. He was the generalist on steroids. He was going to be the ultimate source of knowledge on all subjects. And you know, he came pretty close to it, actually, for his time. So anyway, that's theoretic science. The next branch is called practical science. Only two here. Ethics and politics. His work on ethics is called Nicomachean Ethics. So if you want to jot that down, N-I-C-H-O-M-A-C-H-E-A-N, Nicomachean. Usually thought to be a name honoring his father or possibly his son, both of whom were named Nicomachus. So that's the significance of that as far as anyone can tell. The other one, politics, is his treatment of political science. We do quite a bit in civics. We start off teaching, you know, Aristotle's politics. It's really, it's great. So anyway, that's good stuff. Finally, poetic science. Poetic science also has two sub-points, poetry and rhetoric. Mr. Kimball's not here, is he? But Mr. Kimball, of course, uses rhetoric, Aristotle's rhetoric. And you do too, don't you? Do you? Yeah.
I focus on
rhetoric. Do you? Yeah. All right, so anyway, that's his writings. And I think, you know, the first thing that impresses a person is if you were really going to study Aristotle, then you have to go through all of these, you know, and we'd spend the rest of the year just wading through Aristotle, which is not the purpose of this short course. But at least it gives you a feel for how much breadth he has. And I have to say, not that I've read that much of Aristotle, I've read some, but I have to say I am astonished at his penetrating analytical mind. Whatever he turns to, sometimes he gets very wrong answers, you know, and so we just give him that. He's writing in, what, 350 BC, so give him some credit. But even at that, I mean, the what he writes on politics, I think, is just amazing. Very helpful. The way he just organizes it, gives clear kind of a delineation of the ways to think about things politically. He anticipates American government, constitutional government, even though he'd never really seen it. He describes its basic substructure, what it would take in order for it to work. He says, you know, for a constitutional government to work, it takes a robust, strong middle class. Those are the people who really have the virtue in a society. The super rich, the super poor will tend to rape each other. The middle class, those are the people that go to work, put in a hard day's labor, feel good about it at the end of the day. They don't want to spend their time thinking about politics. They just want to get it done. So they have a kind of practical sort of utility on the subject that is necessary. And he really does just have a wonderful way of describing that. But anyway, Let's focus in, however, on his metaphysics. That's probably where you would typically go. Interesting. A little bit of lore. He wrote metaphysics after he had written physics. And he wasn't quite sure what to call it. You know? Because it was the study of, it was kind of like he wants to follow up on Plato and deal with those subjects. And he didn't know quite the thing to call, he didn't want to call it the ideal world or something like that. So just for a kind of placeholder, he simply calls it metaphysics, which is Greek for after physics, you know. And it stuck. So to this day, metaphysics is what's after physics. Excuse me. Is it warm? Are you warm? I'm kind of warm. Yeah, that's right. I knew you were thinking that. All right. When you hear about Aristotle's metaphysics, you have to think in terms of a kind of a series of distinctions. And so the first famous distinction he makes is between substance and accidents. Anytime you hear that distinction, substance and accidents, one of two thinkers in history will tend to come to mind. Classic distinction. One of them is Aristotle. The other one is, anybody know? Who's the other famous philosopher who makes quite a deal out of the distinction between substance and accidents? Any takers? None? No? Just being modest? Don't know? Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas is a great Aristotelian. That's why Catholic theology has a whole lot of Aristotelian ideas in it. It comes through Thomas, who of course imports it from Aristotle. That basic distinction is one that we all intuitively get. And I think the best way to understand it is just to say substance is what is actually there. This marker, there's something presumably there. Accidents is what I perceive. We usually describe accidents in terms of qualities. Aristotle has 9 qualities. I'm not going to give those to you. If you have a passionate desire to know them, I'll be glad to provide them to you. But things like color, shape, would all be different aspects of these qualities. So I'm holding up this marker, and I'm assuming you all can see it, and you're all having some kind of experience, probably largely visual, of this marker. It has red, it has white, it has a certain shape, you know, those kinds of things. You all are aware, of course, that you may be the subjects of a hallucination, because we know that we can be deceived. We know that our senses can be fooled. And so Aristotle is quite aware of that. Nevertheless, he wants to assume that even though I may be misperceiving this, there's still something there to be perceived. I may not be accurate in what I'm perceiving, but it's not as if there's nothing there at all. Now, that may even be false. Maybe we all have a beautiful mind. We're schizophrenic. And we are, you know. I mean, who knows? Maybe you are just a hallucination. Maybe I'm just dreaming right now. I mean, those are all problems we have to think about, often do, I'm sure. But Aristotle wants to at least say that he believes there is an external world populated by things, and those things, whatever they are, he calls substance. And then what I perceive of them, usually described in terms of qualities, he calls accidents. So accidents here does not mean unfortunate mishaps that happen when you're driving home from school. This is not the sense. But accidents in the philosophical sense is external perceivable qualities. Okay. Substance, what's actually there. Accidents, what I perceive. My senses play an interesting role in my experience. I would experience nothing except for them, and yet they kind of insulate me from the world as well, don't they? I cannot experience this table except through my senses. Yeah. I don't have any direct experience. I can't get inside it. All I can do is see it, touch it, lift it, bite it, smell it. My senses are the only apparatus I have to experience that table. And so in a sense, my senses are there like a screen, a filter that prevents me from actually experiencing it, and yet I need my senses to experience anything. So that's the problem that we start dealing with epistemologically is what do we rely on? See, Plato doesn't trust his senses, so he wants to go inside. He wants to think of a perfect circle, you see, because he feels like he can trust that. Aristotle doesn't like just living in a world of perfect circles. He wants to go out and view things, but he realizes that what we're seeing may be, in fact, misleading. It may be some kind of deception. So that's his basic distinction. Let me ask you, are you aware of any doctrine in Roman Catholic theology which makes quite a deal out of that distinction? Is there any doctrine that comes to mind? Mr. Dowers, what do you have in mind there? Yes, and how would you define the Catholic doctrine of transubstantiation?
That there is actually, there's bread there, but the qualities or the inner parts of it are actually Christ's body.
Okay, yeah, that's right. Y'all know that doctrine, don't you? Transubstantiation. So if you go to a Catholic Mass, the priest will take the elements, the host. He actually doesn't face the people typically. He faces kind of away from them, and he says words in Latin. You don't hear them. He's not speaking. He's to you. But these words in Latin have a kind of efficacy in Roman Catholic thought. It's part of the powers of the priest called sacerdotal powers. And when he says these things, Catholics would teach a miracle happens, right? And the miracle, called the miracle of the Mass, is a transformation of substance. But accidence remains the same. So if you want to be a good, if you want to articulate that doctrine correctly, I've heard it put this way. Well, the Catholics believe that the bread and wine become the body and blood of Christ. And that's partially true. What you actually have to say, to be a little more precise, is Roman Catholics teach that the substance of the bread and wine become the substance of the body and blood of Christ, but the accidents remain those of bread and wine. You see. So here's a case where an Aristotelian distinction to this day is a functional part of Roman Catholic understanding. So that, and Aquinas was, of course, the one who sort of interpreted that into Roman Catholic thought. All right. There's no way to make this really exciting. I just have to kind of just say it. So, with respect to substance, there are a couple of other distinctions. Aristotle is just a world of distinctions, and so that's what we do. We just talk about distinctions. The first distinction is between what he calls primary and secondary. I'm just scribbling, but that's what I'm writing. Primary and secondary substance. Now, I'm just going to say this to you now, and then we'll come back to it a little bit later and see how important it is. Primary substance, in Aristotle's thought, is any given thing. This marker, as an individual existing marker, is primary substance, and it is not the same as this marker. So we have two primary substances here. Marker number one, marker number two. But notice how I've used the same word to apply to both of them. I haven't called this one glip and that one boom. I've called them both what? Marker. Now, Aristotle, we do this intuitively. We don't think about it, but Aristotle looks at that, puts that under a microscope. What have we just done? We have just engaged in something called induction. We have taken a look at two dissimilar objects in many respects. This is red, this is green. This one's upside down, this one's right side up. We've looked at two somewhat dissimilar objects, but we have, through some kind of mental gymnastic, decided we can use the same word to describe both, right? So we say, there's marker, marker. We think, why are you spending so much time telling us this? Because this is the genius of our humanity. And Aristotle says, when we can take any given primary substance and call it by a generic name, we make it, that second name is called secondary substance. In other words, the word marker is kind of a generic way of referring to the class of things in this world that generally meet the description of any one of these things. You follow that? So induction is that process by which I move from primary substance to secondary substance, or if you prefer, from species to genus, from a thing to like things. And he loves to do that. And that is the essence of science for Aristotle. That he goes through the world and he sees just, you know, infinite numbers of things, but he puts them into categories. You are all the category of human, you see. But then we could further classify. There are some humans here that are male, some are female, whatever. We do that. We go through. Think about how profoundly we depend on that ability to make sense out of our experience. If we could not put things into classes so that everything we experienced was one of a kind, you see, what kind of chaos would that be? You know, we just take it for granted. I think there's something here in Aristotle that is very biblical. You know, what comes to your mind when you think about this little insight of Aristotle here? Go ahead.
Well, I guess two things, but one of them is when Adam is naming.
Yeah. Right. And what else? You had some.
Well, I think about how God says that they reproduce after their own kind.
Oh, that's good. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah. Yeah, this is really, you think about, what is it that human beings do that, as far as we know, animals don't do? We have this amazing ability to put names. This is nominalism. We're putting names on things, and by so doing, putting them into classes, and that helps us talk to each other. I can talk to that, I can say that object over there is a man. And just by using that word, I've communicated so much. Otherwise, I'd have to go through line by line, bit by bit, describing every little detail, when in fact, I can just say, man. And you go, bing, 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 I know what that category is. I can put that primary substance into secondary substance. Let's move on, you see. Isn't that wonderful? We can do that? It's amazing, isn't it? We have that capacity. And that's what Aristotle is very interested in. So that's the first distinction with respect to substance. The second, I'll just kind of run it down here, is a distinction between what's called form and matter. So, keep your eye on the ball. With respect to substance, two different distinctions. Primary, secondary, form and matter. Here, he's kind of trying to pay his dues to Plato. So when he talks about form, he's talking about that within a given object, which sort of is the thing that makes it what it is. What is it in this object that we would say makes it a marker and tends to keep it a marker? You know, that's its form. And in a sense, he's echoing Plato's world of the forms here. He doesn't believe in a world of the forms. He doesn't affirm that. But he's trying to give Plato his due. And so that formal idea is what's, you know, in his mind here. Matter is that principle in any given thing that tends toward changing it. You know. I mean, this marker is probably going to remain a marker for a long time, but you could imagine if I walked in here and started hitting it with a ball peen hammer, if I hit it enough times, it would no longer be recognizable as a marker, right? I would have changed it, and the very fact that I can change it represents the fact that there is in this thing not only form, but also matter. We are all gripped in the drama of the conflict between form and matter. You know. Heraclitus was the one who really gave us this with the greatest zeal. And I'm trying to remember now, did we talk about wrinkles with Heraclitus? Did I do that? Wrinkles? That doesn't ring a bell? Oh, good. Because you see, I like to, it's always the female students I like to kind of. Every one of us in this room, but especially the female students, are made up of both form and matter. Form is that principle in you that tends to keep you in your youthful beauty. Matter is the tyranny of old age, what you are gradually becoming. So, you just think about it. We've been going now for 45 minutes. Well, 40 minutes. In 40 minutes, you've aged, haven't you? 40 minutes. You are 40 minutes older. And of course, in 40 minutes, we can imagine that at some very tiny, minuscule, microscopic level, you've developed maybe a couple of wrinkles. Isn't this lovely? Don't you love philosophy? You know? Well, I'm further down the road than anyone in this room. So, you know, I feel like I'm peculiarly authorized to speak on the subject of the phenomenon known as old age. You see, I look and sometimes I get up in the morning and I look at myself in the mirror and I think, who are you? Why is this circles, hair looks, it just, you're an old man. What do you, then I put on my makeup, you know, you have no idea. Oh, it's just alarming. And Aristotle, of course, notices that virtually everything we experience has a little bit of both, has that in it, which is retarding change. It's like an inertia that keeps things from changing. But there's also in everything that principle which tends toward change. And we're all locked in a sort of struggle, we humans, and everything else in the world. So some things are mostly form. Let's say you've got something that is 99% form, only 1% matter. Just think theoretically about that. And then imagine that you've got, you can imagine something that's 1% form and 99% matter. Mr. Dupree, what would be the characteristics of something that is 99% form and 1% matter? What kind of thing, or maybe an example you can come up with that would meet that description?
Solid.
Yes.
Like a rock.
It's very good. Yeah, the Egyptians built their pyramids out of rocks because they believed rocks were nearly eternal. They'd never read Aristotle, but they believed, you know, in, at least the idea was that it's mostly form. A rock is going to stay a rock. Ms. Muse? Can you think of something that would be 1% form and 99% matter? What would it? What qualities would it have?
Quickly changes.
That's right. Quickly changes. Like, can you think of anything then?
Boiling water.
It's pretty good. Yeah. You know, let's imagine we do a little experiment here, and I walk in with two objects. We're going to run an experiment. One of the objects is a brick of gold, and one is a little fluff of cotton candy. Okay, and I put them both in the front of the room, put them on this table right here, and I say, okay, we're going to come back in 1,000 years. You know, and we're going to see what is there where we put the brick of gold and where we put the cotton candy. So, Ms. Culberson, what do you expect we would find if we came back undisturbed? No one's been in the room. It's been, you know, hermetically sealed. It's, you know, it's safe. No tomb robbers have gotten in here. And so we have a brick of gold, cotton candy. What do you expect we would find where we left the brick of gold 1,000 years from now?
I'm going to go for the gold. I'm going to say there's still
gold. I think there's probably going to be almost, you'd have to dust it off, but I think you'd say it had changed probably imperceptibly. You would find there'd been no noticeable change. You know. What about the cotton candy? What do you think about that? That's right. Do you think there'd be any trace of it?
I don't think so.
I don't think there'd be a trace. I mean, maybe you'd find a little speck or two of sugar. Something, you know, in 1,000 years, it would. In 100 years, it would be gone in a year, because it is so much more ephemeral, isn't it? It just changed. So that's what Aristotle notices. He goes through life and he notices that things have varying degrees of either form or matter in them. Some things tend to change very rapidly. They tend to not have much stability. They are mostly matter. There are some things that are great, permanent, unchanging. Those are mostly form. Then he goes to the extremes and has a theoretical idea of something that is 100% form and 0% matter. And down here, something that is 0% form and 100% matter. These are theoretical ideas. What do you suppose he calls, what is his name for that thing that would be 100% form, 0% matter, never changing? He would call that God. So Aristotle's God is mainly a philosophical principle, an idea. Aristotle is a theist. But he's kind of a theist out of necessity. He doesn't encourage us to worship this God. Certainly doesn't encourage us to have any relationship with that God. He doesn't even believe that's possible. But he has an idea philosophically that demands that there be some kind of God there. And the way he conceives of that God philosophically, it's actually, you know what it is, it's potentially nothing. On the other hand, when you talk about something 100% matter, it's in a sense potentially anything, but actually nothing. And so for him, matter is only a philosophical idea. It's not; it is actually nothing, you know. And so that in you that is changing, that matter is in a sense a principle of nothing. It's that in you which is tending to make you become nothing. And form is trying to keep you, in a sense, in a state of some sort of being. So it's the being and nothingness, what's called motif in philosophy. There's a very famous 20th century philosopher who wrote just a weighty philosophical work called Being and Nothingness. And his name is, anybody know? Carolyn, do you know? Being and Nothingness. Famous philosopher, you know the name. His name is Jean-Paul Sartre, you see. And he's just continuing this same conversation. And he's an existentialist because he sees us trapped between being and nothingness, and we're in this despair of being just existing beings, existing, you know. And the despair of existentialism really is in a sense, understood in the parameters that Aristotle himself gave us. All right, so, does that make sense so far? So far, so good? You're all doing great? You actually appear to be awake. It's quite amazing. Please.
So with Aristotle's substance of going from primary to secondary,
yes.
Like with the two markers,
right.
And both by markers,
right.
Do you know if he would say that that's like a form of abstraction?
Yeah, he would. That is abstraction.
Idea.
Yeah. I think induction, another legitimate word for that would be abstraction. You're moving from the concrete to the less concrete, or from the concrete to the abstract. Yeah. This much. If Aristotle's God is a God of pure form, then that also means this is a God who does not change, cannot change. And if God cannot change, then that means that in a sense God cannot even be aware of us. Because if he's aware of my changing life, that implies some little change in the mind of God, you see. So Aristotle's God is indifferent to you, doesn't know you, doesn't care about you. You know, this is a God that is there as a philosophical necessity only. He believes this God is out there. But the great kind of classic, I don't think Aristotle said this, but the little kind of joking line is that Aristotle's God exists in a perfect state of reflection throughout eternity on himself, and usually the way you'll hear it is reflecting on his own navel, you know. And Aristotle's God is only thinking about Aristotle's God. And everything else is here by a kind of necessity. God didn't decide to create, it's just, in a sense, a necessary effect of the fact that God is there, which became a very Greek view of God that, you know, led to Gnosticism and so on. Yeah, go ahead. If you're familiar with the contemporary debate over process philosophy or process theology, you're probably at least aware that there's this whole kind of school of thought out there that God must be changing, you know, that God is growing and that kind of thing, if you're familiar with that. In some ways, those who have taken that view sort of create this false dilemma. They say that if you don't take that view of God, then you are by necessity forced to have an Aristotelian God who is sort of trapped in his own ontology and can do nothing, you know, as if there's no third way to deal with it. And then they quote verses like God is the same yesterday, today, and forever, and you know, that kind of thing. So anyway, it's a little bit of a contemporary theological debate that goes right back to Aristotle's. The way it works is it would accuse somebody like me, for example, who does not endorse process philosophy, of by the nature of the case, therefore, I must believe in Aristotle's God, you see. It's like trying to paint me into a corner, if that makes any sense. All right, the next little distinction here, we've got form and matter, and this leads then, this is as much as I'm going to give you, so just one more little paragraph. This leads to Aristotle's rather well-known four causes. Aristotle is concerned about change. He notices that things change. He notices that things don't change in an utterly random way, that there's some kind of reason that things change, and so he begins to think about what is it? What is the force, as it were, or the forces that lead to change? And he has at least a couple here that seem to occur to him. So his four causes start with what's called a formal cause and a material cause. And then he has two other causes. Anybody ever come across this? If you've studied this, go ahead. That word would actually fit with the formal cause.
So you got formal, material, and then there's the effect.
Yes. Got to give you that. Efficient cause.
Thank you.
And then there's one other. Yeah, well, not exactly. That's the formal cause. The plan, yeah.
Formal, I don't remember.
Okay, last one is, very good. That's good. Final cause. Okay. His famous illustration of this is a block of marble. I was telling when in philosophy just about 2 weeks ago, I'm reluctant to mention this here, but I was kind of joking with the students. I was saying, I assume in 200 or 300 years when the Oaks has become this world-famous institution, having displaced, of course, Harvard University and all the, it will be the Oaks that will be the institution of, you know, most worldwide reputation. And I was telling the students, I don't even know if I should tell you this, but I was just joking. As I was sure that when we have a wonderful facility, there's going to be a wonderful statue of Mr. Gore out in front. You know? Hair on the chest. It's just going to be, it's going to be a sight to behold.
And a little bit more
Mr. Gore in his prime is what we're picturing now, you know. So anyway, I was asking them, here we have a block of marble, and here we have what it eventually became, this glorious statue of Mr. Gore. And then I was asking, what caused that change so that marble became Gore? So, the formal cause would be what? We have, Aristotle would say there's four causes that produce the change. So what's going to be the formal cause? Ms. Allard, what do you think? The form? What is a form? What would you think of? Ask your neighbor. I bet Ms. Nolan knows. Gary, what do you think? Come on.
The shape.
The shape, the plan, right? The form. So anyway, the formal cause, we're going to say, is something like the blueprint. You know, you're never going to come up with a statue unless the guy doing the work has some kind of idea. You send me out there and with a hammer and chisel to go to work on a block of marble, you're going to get very much, because I not only don't have much of a plan in my mind, nor do I have the skills to do it, but you know, Michelangelo going to work on this has a plan. He has an idea. He already sees inside the marble that statue. It's in there hiding. He just has to remove all the external stuff and bring it out, right? That's what he's going to, so that's his plan. What do you think would be the material cause? That's an easy one. What's the material cause of the statue? It'd be what? The marble, right, is the material. What's the efficient cause? Okay, yeah, it would be, he actually includes the hammer and chisel as part of the broader category of simply the sculptor. So the sculptor is the efficient cause, the one that effects the change, you know. And then the final cause is what? Mr. Young, you were the one that was all over this. Do you know what's the final cause here? Yeah. What were you going to say, Laurie? No?
Just the final product.
The final product is the statue, but there's something else in play. Anybody? The final cause is?
Is it the desire to commemorate Gore? Or?
I like that. That is a nice sound. Let's talk later. You know, yeah, it's sort of, it's more broad than that. It's the reason why. Why do it? You know, Michelangelo is a great sculptor, but hey, it's still a lot of work to produce the David. You know, we'll change the... I see too many... I'm getting tired of all the rolling eyes in the room, and now I think I've even made it worse. But in any event, that's the reason. Why does Michelangelo go to work on this thing? Why does he go to all the trouble? I mean, it is it's a painstaking process, and maybe it's the money, maybe it's aesthetic pleasure, maybe it's somebody put a gun to his head. Something has gotten him up off the couch and into the sculpting room there, whatever. So anyway, that's his. His understanding then of what causes things to change. That was also important at the time of the Reformation, because in the Reformation there was an awful lot of interest in the phrase by faith alone. And the question they talked about in the context of Aristotle's four causes is, in what sense is faith a cause? The word by implies causation. We're justified by faith. In what sense does faith cause justification? You know, and you think about it; it isn't real obvious. What's the formal cause of justification? What's the form? What are we? Pardon me. That's right. The image of Christ. You know, what's the material cause of a justified person? What do you start with? What do you? What? A sinner. Yeah. What's the efficient cause of a justified person? Christ, or actually Paul says in Romans 8 at least, it is God who justifies. God justifies. What's the final cause?
For His glory.
For His glory. Where'd faith come in? Huh? I'm going to leave you to ponder that. Till next we meet. But other comments or questions just in general about this? Yeah, you have to say what Aristotle gives is this great framework for thinking. He's not, you know, you might say Plato's on a soapbox. He's really trying to preach a message. And Socrates is his great hero. And it's virtue, it's goodness, it's lofty ideas. Plato's really, he's trying to move you somewhere. Aristotle, not so much. He's just like almost a genius technician. He's just helping us think about what this business is of knowing anything. And then he goes right off and starts looking at all that stuff and trying to explain it. Please.
So how does induction work for him if he's got this screen?
Well, he believes in the basic reliability of sense perception. He believes your senses, generally speaking, are giving you an accurate but sensory experience of a thing. And so he believes that whatever is actually out there, marker A, marker B, that they bear enough similarity to each other as discovered by our senses, that it's legitimate for us to put them together. But he always guards saying, we never really know for sure. You know, Kant is going to come along, to skip way ahead, and he's going to doubt that whole reality out there. And he has what he calls the Copernican revolution of philosophy. Instead of a philosophy in which we think there's an objective world and we are the observers looking at it and trying to figure it out, Kant flips it all over and says the real focus of philosophy is the thinker. And he begins to kind of dismiss that, what he calls, noumenal world of objective things. And there's much more interest now in my experience of those markers than the character of the markers themselves. You know. Well, we're not nearly there with Aristotle. Aristotle still really does believe that there is this world out there, and that our senses are giving us at least a decent expression of what that is.
So does he have certainty about you,
Aristotle? Well, he has scientific certainty, meaning he has high probability. Plato thinks he's giving you certainty. He thinks that perfect circle in your mind there, Charlie, is something of which you can be certain. You've never seen a perfect circle in your life, but you have certainty about it because it's in your mind. Aristotle, his MMO is he goes out and looks at circles. But a better example would be he goes out and looks at squirrels, or he looks at pine trees, or he looks at concrete objects in the real world, and begins to abstract from his observations generalizations about the nature of reality. But you never know for sure. You're always just dealing with probability quotients. Yeah.
So would Plato would be deduction, whereas Aristotle would be deduction?
Yeah, right. That's exactly right. So Plato, emphasis on deduction. Aristotle, emphasis on induction. But Aristotle has a very important place for deduction. Aristotle has more of a place for deduction than Plato has a place for induction. Okay? Sorry. It deteriorates as we go. All right. I get impatient, you know. All right. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Socrates is mortal, right? You've all seen that syllogism. Is that deduction or induction?
Yes.
That's deduction. Yes, he says. Yeah, that's right. Why do you say that, Mr. Ingarn? I think you've given a more profound answer than...
You can't really do one without the other.
That's right. How so?
I don't know.
All right. All right. See?
You've got to start somewhere.
Partial genius. That's right. All right. What is it? It is... Go ahead.
Would it be because...
Yeah, you're on the right track. Yeah. Yeah. You think about, you know, if it is true that all men are mortal, and if it is true that Socrates is a man, then can we say with certainty that Socrates is mortal? Yes, that's deduction. The problem is, how do we know that all men are mortal? How do we know that? Answer?
Induction.
Induction. We observe men. We notice that so far, men die. You know. Now, not all men have died, have they? You realize that most of the people that have ever lived in human history are alive right now. So less than half of all people that have ever lived have died. You know? But we have a pretty good statistical probability that even though most men have not died, all men certainly will die. Unless, of course, they're raptured. But that's a different question. So we have all men are mortal. Only because we have observed and extrapolated from the data a generalization based on scientific observation about men. Then we go and we look at a particular man, Socrates. Kent kind of looks like a Socrates. I go over, you know, I feel him, check him out. Yeah, seems to me that creature is a man. But how did I reach the conclusion that Socrates is a man? What process did I go through? Mr. Dykstra, what did I do? I induced it, didn't I? Yeah. I had to look at him and observe him. This is not a deduction. So we have induction produces premise number one, and induction produces premise number two, and then and only then can I say by deduction that that thing follows. So that's why Mr. Ingard was quite correct when he says it's both. You know. Descartes, later we're going to find, tries to avoid the problem of induction. His little way of avoiding the inductive aspect of this is by starting not with all men are mortal, but with what? Go ahead.
I think.
That's right. Cogito. Ergo. What?
Sum.
I think. Did I figure that out inductively? Well, you can debate that, but Descartes would say no. You know, that I reach the conclusion that I think by pure logic. And if I am thinking, then I can by pure logic conclude that I must exist. And so he starts his whole understanding of knowledge on what he believes is a deductive and certain premise. I should say a clear and certain premise from which he can deduce, you know, everything else. Descartes a little later, but at least you see how the thing goes here. Anything else?
No, I don't want to.